From the land of the Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 24th day of May, 2023. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Greg Johnson. We'll hear from Andrew Margonaut, who will be on the PBS stage this evening on site here on the campus of the U of I. You can join us. We'll give you details about that. We'll also hear from Drew Lerner at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. And if you can stay with us for the second half hour today, we'll discuss crop budgets. They're not good. They've changed with Gary Schnitke, agricultural economist, and hear about climate mitigation as it's related to today's PBS event on campus with Greg Page. This is an interview I did with the CEO of Cargill at the time in 2023, all on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. July corn today up 9 3/4, December 3 1/4 higher, and soybeans finished unchanged in the August. July up 2, November down 2 3/4 at 11.85. Greg Johnson now joins us from TGM. That's Total Grain Marketing from right here in Champaign County to discuss what's happened in the marketplace. A couple of days this week, three in fact, where there's been some upturn in the marketplace. Can you tell me if this is just a pop after the market's being oversold, or there's something underpinning the move?
I think it's a combination. You know, technically we hit some downside price points, and so we were due to bounce a little bit, but probably more importantly, we needed a reason for those short sellers to cover their positions, and the reason is the forecast. It has turned off dry. The next 10 days to 2 weeks, there's very little rain in the forecast. And for certain areas that have had very little rain in April and May, like Champaign County, it could start getting concerning. I was just looking back at some rainfall totals in April at the Illinois State Water Survey in Champaign, only got 1.47 inches in April and 1.92 in May, if you assume it's not going to rain anymore in the month of May. So that 3.39 inches in April, May, is the second driest April and May that we've had since I've been here in over 40 years. And the driest year, people may not want to hear this, is 1988 when we had 85 bushel corn, a half a crop. Now, the other 3 years that we had dry April and Mays, we had sub trend line yields as well. When we were averaging in the 170s and 180s in 2001, we had 153 bushel corn for Champaign County, 164 in 2005, and 188 in 2007. So, you know, the concern is that it's going to stay dry for a while, and, you know, hopefully it doesn't, but at least for the next 2 weeks it has. And with the big sell-off that we've seen, I think it was a lot easier for the market to rally a little bit based on these forecasts of dry weather for the next 10 days to 2 weeks.
Now, on that note, the Illinois State climatologist, Trent Ford, who you hear on the air here on Friday afternoons just before 3 o'clock after the Commodity Week program, had written a note and was asking producers and others in some of the driest regions, and he has a nice map that's now up on our website at willag.org, up in the state of Illinois this week, and because of the coming dry weather, wanting to know what the impact was and trying to assess what that really means and how dry it is for producers, and asking them to fill out a form so that he, as the state climatologist, can have more information. Again, that link is at willag.org as well, so look for that right there. Now, given all of that, do farmers feel like this is an opportunity or not?
Not yet, no. We lost 90 cents and we've gained back 30. So, you know, once we gain back half of the loss, then I think farmers will be a little bit more willing to at least think about selling. But if my experience is worth anything, my in past experience has told me that as long as it's hot and dry, most farmers aren't going to sell. They're going to want to wait until there's some rain in the forecast. And of course, if they wait too long when there's rain in the forecast, then the market could turn around and start going back down. But until there's a better chance of rain, I don't think we're going to be inundated with phone calls from farmers wanting to sell anything.
What do you see in the way of old crop need at this point, demand, from the end users?
The export market has been very disappointing. So the end users, the domestic end users, feeders and processors, think that they've got the market to themselves. They're trying to walk the basis lower as we try to transition from old crop $6 corn to new crop $5 corn. So eventually those two will have to come together. But I think we've got a long ways to go before that happens. And, you know, the processors and the feeders need corn every week. So we've seen basis levels drop last week, but this week they've improved again. And I think you're going to see that stop and start, hit and miss, up and down activity in the basis because they have to have corn every week. So I don't know that we're over with yet on as far as basis is concerned. Eventually, yes. Eventually, the old crop basis will slip to new crop levels, but that's still 3 months away.
I can recall many times people will say, you know, you're going to hold on to it for a higher price, but from what level will that higher price come? it's always an interesting debacle to have to worry about. And the $5 cash corn, by the way, I'm 10 under that. I wish that were still the case in some areas too, but it's not. What do we know about soybeans today?
Well, the soybeans, there's a couple of things there. Number one, the dry weather doesn't impact the soybeans near as much as the corn in the short term. Beans can hang on a lot longer. Their critical time is not till late July, early August, where the corn is more early July. But the flip side is the ending stocks number is still a lot tighter on soybeans than it is on corn, and the demand seems to be there. Export sales are basically right on pace to meet USDA's numbers on soybeans, whereas, you know, we'll probably have to drop the USDA export number once again because we're still running behind on corn. So there's demand for beans and the stocks are a lot tighter. So that's the plus for the soybean market, but the traders just don't seem to be too worried about beans right now because they think the beans can hang on for a while until we get to that critical point weather-wise.
Hey, thank you much.
All right, thank you, Todd.
That's Greg Johnson. He is with TGM. That's Total Grain Marketing. This evening at 6 o'clock on the Quad, the PBS NewsHour will be on campus to talk about agriculture and the climate. You can join us. I'll give you more information about that in just a moment. Andrew Marganat, who is a crop scientist at the U of I, will be part of the panel discussion. Andrew joins us now. Hey, Andrew, thank you very much. Can you tell me what you've been up to so far today?
This morning I was in a cornfield about 20 miles north of campus. Soil sampling as part of a project that is funded by USDA, and it focuses on how diversification of cropping systems in the Midwest might entail different benefits for soils being more healthy, as well as financial sustainability of farming operations. And in this case, it was a cover crop field where there was corn coming out at about V2, V3 stage, from a really beautiful rye cover crop that had been killed about 3 weeks ago.
Sounds like not a bad way to transition to your PBS event on campus tonight, which everybody can come to. It starts at 6 o'clock, or they can watch it on YouTube, and there's a link at willag.org. Just go there, willag.org, and you can start it at 6 o'clock. I think you'll have to push play on it, but it's easy enough. And I suppose it is really a nice transition for you from being in the field this morning, working on healthy soils, and then talking about that and climate this evening on campus with PBS.
It couldn't be a better day, Todd. I think it's important to stay grounded, especially in these kinds of discussions. And so it was nice to be out there sampling with our team. And this evening, as you pointed out, correct, we will have a discussion along with a series of experts, and the discussion will be focused on how climate change is impacting agriculture, and there's a big focus on agriculture in the Corn Belt, and they chose Illinois for a very good reason. We are the heart of the Corn Belt, and we're one of the most productive lands in the world. The discussion will focus on a lot of questions that I think the public has. So the purpose in my eyes of this, from what I've been told and from what I've been seeing as part of my lead up to this, is the public often has questions about, well, how are we seeing nutrient losses continue? How are we going to deal with the effects of increased rainfall severity events? We're looking at a 3-inch rainfall in 2 hours, for example. What's the deal with cover crops? So these are questions that I think a lot of the farmers in our landscapes are well aware of. And I mean, after all, they're the ones doing the work and doing the conservation in the first place. So this is meant more to communicate to the public that has really good questions on how this all works. And that's what my job is to do, is help inform the public.
And you'll be there for an hour and a half. This is not a short event. Folks can send questions in. There's a form online that they'll be able to fill out, all kinds of things. And it's just not you. Lauren Lerkins from the Illinois Farm Bureau will be on hand, and a whole bunch of others, right?
That's correct. I believe there's a congresswoman there as well. There's a few scientists that work on plant breeding and on physiology response to crops to climate change or drought. It is a very good mix from scientists. There's going to be a farmer as well, Michael Ganshaw from Bureau County near Walnut. He will be there as well, which I'm very grateful for that they actually have a farmer present. I think that's essential for these discussions. This is good because it crosses from the people actually doing the practices to the scientists to the policymakers. And that's exactly what I think we need for these kinds of discussions to be effective, for the public to understand the reality of agriculture.
Yeah, the farmer is a graduate from the College of ACES, so he's an alumni from the university, another tie to the university. The congresswoman is actually, as you said, there will be a congresswoman there. Debbie Sabinaugh, senator, will be, I believe, online. That's the way I saw that listed. And, of course, she is one of the four people that's really responsible for driving the farm bill, which is now under consideration in Washington, D.C., the 2023 version of this. So a lot of people that will be working towards issues that need to be addressed in the farm bill. And this is a good way for everybody to have their thoughts heard. Again, it's possible to send in questions ahead of time. There's a form. You can find the links at willag.org. And Andrew, what's your impression about how you will be involved? I mean, what kinds of things will they be asking? Do you know? Do you have an idea what the discussion will look like?
It's a good question, Todd. So they've given me a rundown of what to expect. There's going to be a hybrid of recorded clips of some of the members on the panel, as well as people that won't be there live. And that will be interspersed, I believe, with questions from the public that are going to be selected for by Miles O'Brien, the host. And those will be asked of the live panel directly. And these clips cover a whole gamut of topics that run from what might seem like a naive question to those of us in ag, but are really important questions for the general public who, say, live in cities or are on these coasts who don't know how it works. And so I think there's going to be a mix of education as well as prompting of questions in the clips and then to the panel, questions that have to do with things like, what are ways forward where we can implement practices like cover crops at scale? And this is, again, why I think having a farmer like Michael is essential, as well as a policymaker and researchers.
And on the policy side, Jonathan Kappas, member of the Farm Dog team here on campus, will be one of those clips. He's an agricultural policy specialist. It should be a really good program. I bet you're looking forward to it. I'm planning to be there, and I can't wait to see what happens tonight. All of that takes place just south of the Illini Union on the quad, so you'll have to find a parking space and then walk in, but you're welcome. It's 6 o'clock tonight, or you can watch it online. I bet you're looking forward to it, and thank you very much for taking the time with me, and we'll talk with you again this evening, Andrew.
Sure thing, Todd. I look forward to seeing you this evening, and thanks for getting the word out on this event.
That's Andrew Marginot. He is a crop scientist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. We'll participate in this evening's PBS News Hour, hour and a half long, live streamed to YouTube event. You can too. You can either buy on campus this evening at 6 o'clock, just to the south of the Illini Union on the quad, or do it online. You can find all that information on our website at willag.org, willag.org. Let's check the weather forecast now. Drew Lerner is here from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Hi, Drew. Thank you for being with us. We have a lot to cover today. Let's start with the Midwest, particularly Illinois. We're going to focus on just a bit because the state climatologist made a call in the last 28 to 48 hours for people to fill out some information about how the dry weather, drought conditions in some strips across the state are impacting them. He's worried about the next 10 days. Are you worried about the next 10 days as well?
Well, worries, that's a tough word to define here. that most importantly, the situation is not going to be critical, but we're not going to do well with rainfall. So it's not going to be excessively hot. We're going to be cool for the first few days of that 10-day period, and then we're going to warm up. And at the very end of the period, we'll get a chance for some showers. Now, it's not going to be a soaking rain. So we'll keep a moisture deficit in the soil as we go further into June. And so am I worried about it right now? No, but I might be a little bit more interested in it as we go deeper into June. If we get through this 10-day period and we start looking out another 10 days and we still don't see better rains, then I might become a little more concerned about the situation. And to be honest with you, I think that's the direction we will go in. I think our rainfall for the month of June is going to be less than normal, and we will see a return of warmer weather a little bit later down the road. So I worried not yet, but it is something that should be on everybody's radar, and we will be watching real closely to see what happens when we get into the middle and latter parts of the month. But I do not expect to see the kind of summer June rains that we normally get.
Do the models show rainfall or not at this point?
The models do suggest that there will be some scattered showers occurring in that second week of the outlook, but they aren't necessarily real well put together showers. What I'm trying to say, yeah, there's going to be some moisture, but we're not going to fix moisture deficits in a big way. We'll moisten the topsoil, but we're still going to want more rain by the time we're done with that period.
It's not as good as the models maybe are showing. In Canada, we talked a lot about the weather there. We probably ought to discuss some of the driest regions. Are they getting relief?
The driest areas in Canada will not. That would include east, central, and southern parts of Alberta and the westernmost portions of Saskatchewan. Those areas are in a multi-year drought, extremely dry. There's no subsoil moisture. The crops are not doing well in that area. There have been some showers. They are planting, but there's a lot of concern that without rain, that they're going to do a lot of wilting here over the next few weeks. But the rest of the prairies, a totally different story. Western Alberta has just had 2 to 3 days of really good rain. They picked up on maybe 3/4 inch to over 2 inches in some of the far western crop areas there in that province. And Saskatchewan's getting ready for a series of disturbances that actually begins today and will continue into Tuesday or Wednesday of next week that will bring rain to almost all areas except for those along the Alberta border, where there will be ongoing drought conditions there. But the moisture in the rest of Saskatchewan will be sufficient to take their topsoil moisture from the very short category, which is raising a lot of concern right now because of recently planted crops, to an adequate level. And there may even be a handful of locations that might be a little wet, but only for a brief few days, my guess is. Manitoba will also get some rain, but it's probably not going to be as great there as it will be in Saskatchewan. So we'll see what happens.
Let's talk wheat now. The hard red winter wheat crop in the United States suffered a drought. Then, hey, we got some rain. It's looking great. No, it's not really. But what's the weather like there?
Yeah, just like you said, it's a little mixed. You know, we've got some fields out there that have actually seen a little bit of improvement, but it's so late in the season. And what a rough year it's been for the crop out there. There's not much reason for us to expect any big turnarounds, but it is raining now, and there is some chatter about it raining too frequently in parts of Oklahoma and Texas where the crop is, you know, finishing up. And they do need to see some sunny, dry weather. It looks like there'll be rain in the forecast almost every day over the next 10 days in a part of that region. So that's one of the reasons for the chatter. And there's been some talk out there about Kansas being involved with that too. But, you know, I don't think, first of all, the Kansas crop is going to get nearly the rain frequency and the amounts that we'll see down in Texas and western Oklahoma. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that I just don't think that there's much crop in Kansas that is left to be seriously beat up. But, you know, obviously, if the crop is mature and we get a bunch of rain, that's not a good thing for it. But I would be more concerned about Texas and western Oklahoma than I would be Kansas.
What about the wheat in Argentina? That crop is going in the ground.
Yes, it is. And the month of June is the most important month. That's when the majority of that crop will be seeded. And You know, they're having some very well-timed precipitation events right now. We had some rain this past week since we talked last, and that has moistened up the soil in probably the eastern two-thirds of the wheat production region. And we are going to see another round of rain coming up here in the next few days that will add icing on that cake. But we are not getting that much moisture to occur in La Pampa and westernmost parts of Buenos Aires or in parts of Cordoba. It won't be absolutely dry there, but that is the western part of the their wheat production region, and they do need more moisture than what's going to occur. I don't think it's a crisis, and I do see more rain coming as we go forward through the next 30 days. So I don't think there's much to worry about, but it's something to talk about, I suppose.
Anything in Western or Eastern Europe that we should discuss?
Europe's kind of stuck in a mode right now where it rains frequently in the south. This would be from Spain and Portugal through southern France into Italy and on eastward into some of the what I call the Balkan countries, which is from Hungary southward. Those areas, there is some of that region that's become rather wet here recently. Spain has been dealing with a kind of a droughty pattern for an extended period of time. Their winter crops didn't do that well. They do a lot of irrigating there. We were looking at their water supply last week, and there's a lot of southern Spain that only has about 25% of the normal water in reserve right now. And by the way, France also has some very low groundwater right now. So if Western Europe ends up going back into a warmer and drier scenario like we had last summer, boy, these crops will deteriorate real fast. But for right now, we're in a frequent precipitation pattern in those southern areas of Europe. And for right now, I don't think it's hurting too much, but there is some wheat that is going to be maturing pretty soon, and they are going to need some drier weather.
And finally, anything from Russia or Ukraine?
You know, the biggest thing in Russia right now is in their New Lands region, which is from the Ural Mountains over towards Siberia. And that area produces some important spring wheat and sunseed. And it looks like they're going to continue to dry down. They've had bouts of drying so far this season, but they still have a fair amount of moisture in the soil today. And I think that they're going to be all right, but it's kind of like the U.S. Midwest. I think as we go forward through the next 10 days, that ground's going to firm up. And if we get to the end of that 10-day period and we look out another 10 days after that, and we don't have better rain coming, then I think we'll start hearing some noise coming out of there. So these next 10 to 15 days in that part of Russia will probably be fairly important. And we'll want to keep an eye on that and make sure that they do get some rain. The forecast at the moment doesn't look that great. And when I try to stick my neck out into the second week of the outlook and on into the third week, I see a little bit of shower activity, but I don't think they're going to get a lot. So that might be an area of topic down the road.
Hey, thanks much.
Have a good day.
You too. That's Drew Lerner at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Stay with us here on the Closing Market Report. It's an extended version today. We'll hear from Gary Schnitke. Gary Schnitke, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois, now joins us for an important update. This is kind of a mid-season update. I don't recall whether you usually do this at this time of year or not, but you have updated the 2023 corn and soybean budgets. You put this on the FarmDoc website at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. It's titled Back to Normal. So did you update because of the downturn in the marketplace? Is that what prompted it? And do you normally update it this time of year?
Yeah, we usually update our budgets several times in the year. We are doing it later in the year this time. And the decline in corn and soybean prices since essentially February have prompted that update at this point in time. And we've had a considerable fall since setting our projected prices for corn and soybeans in February.
Okay, so I'm reading through the beginning of this. I think producers will actually be happy. While you've had a considerable fall, it's not nearly as far down as what USDA projected at $4.80 for their season's average cash price. You went from $5.50 from your December number to $5 for corn. That feels better than $4.80 for sure.
Yeah, we went to $5 for corn. And remember, we're projecting the 2023 projected price. $5 is still consistent with where futures prices are, particularly if you store after harvest. And we're using five also because farmers have hedged some of their grain at higher prices this spring. So we went down to five, but still that is a fall, and we're getting closer to what those long run average prices have been at over time.
Can you talk about those long run average prices just a bit?
Yeah. So agricultural economists believe that commodity prices have a long run that doesn't change that often. If we look at corn since 2006, we've had an average of 447 for corn and 1064 for soybeans. And there isn't really anything out there that would suggest we have changed that plateau now, but we've had higher prices above that because of some sort of a supply problem around the world in the last several years. And now we're getting back to normal where we're hitting good yields, and Brazil had good yields last year, and we're off to a good start. Obviously, there's a lot to have happened between now and harvest, but planting progress would say we're sitting in a pretty good place as far as yields.
Well, let's talk about the crop budgets in more detail. Can you tell me what changed and what impact it has on the bottom lines?
So the big change is that we're lowering prices, and those prices are considerably down from 2022 prices when we had $6.40 for corn and $14 for soybeans. We have also continued to increase non-land costs from 2022 to 2023. And part of that is just cost have went up. And while we have had declines, particularly in fertilizer in recent months, many farmers still are going to average higher in fertilizer prices in 2023 than they did in 2022, because there was some opportunity to price some of those inputs earlier in the year. Overall, though, if we look at farmer return after paying an average cash rent, we are at a negative level, and it's minus $56 per acre for 2023. That's after paying an average cash rent. We're using a 363 for average cash rent for Central Illinois. That gets us at a negative number, and the last time we've had negative numbers was in 2014 and 2015. And that 2014 and 2015 came off of high returns in 2012 and 2011 when we had higher prices. So we're getting back to normal.
This is across the whole of the farm for the rotation, corn and soybeans combined?
Yep. We're looking, those numbers that we're looking at a 307 operator and farmland return. That's an average of corn and soybeans, 50% corn, 50% soybeans, and cash rent of 363 gives us a negative number. Again, that's where we're at now, $5 corn and $12.30 for soybeans. We're back at those levels. And so we're going to have to begin planning probably for those price levels as we do 2024 planning. That's not, those prices and those returns likely won't cause financial stress on many farms in 2023 because of the good years we had in 2021 and 2022, but still we're looking at lower returns compared to those years, 2021 and 2022.
If you divided out corn budget and soybean budget, what does that bottom line look like? Does one crop do better than the other?
Yeah, right now, corn looks worse than soybeans. Minus $99 return for corn, minus $13 for soybeans. So, yeah, you get the average of those two. Again, we are using yields at trend. So that's for Central Illinois. We're using 227 bushels for corn, 72 bushels for soybeans. We'll see where we end up. And obviously, July weather will have a lot to do with that.
And a $363 cash rent price in those budgets as well.
And $363 cash rent price, that's what we're using is average, and we know that there's over $400 cash rents out there. And that did work last year. It probably won't result in positive returns this year. And again, it's going to lead to some negotiations and difficulties setting 2024 cash rents and all of the costs that go with 2024.
Not sure I want to say thank you, but thank you. Yeah. That's Gary Schnitke. He's an agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Now let's return to a topic we heard earlier in the hour when we were speaking with Andrew Marcinot, a crop scientist from the University of Illinois, that will be joining the PBS discussion on campus tonight at 6 o'clock. You can do that as well, either online through YouTube, find that at willag.org, or right there in person on the quad. Look for the Illini Union, and on the south side of that, you'll find us at 6 o'clock. This will run for about an hour and a half. It includes Andrew and a whole series of other folks talking about climate and agriculture and mitigation. That last part is the part I'd like to take up at this point. In 2013, just about 10 years ago, I did an interview with the CEO at the time of Cargill about a grant that he had been involved with to create a website where data could be collected. You'll hear more about that in just a minute. And the riskybusiness.org website, it's still operational. And the kinds of mitigation that this group of people thought might be necessary for agriculture and the infrastructure in the United States, around the planet for that matter, as we move through this century. It's very interesting. I hope you enjoy it. Here's the conversation I had with Greg Page in 2013. A group of business people and political leaders have funded a project called Risky Business. It assesses ways to mitigate the financial impact of climate change through the end of the century. The study does not propose ways to mitigate the problem, but rather offers data to anyone who wants to use it as a way to assess financial risk and find potential solutions to things like a rise in sea levels or drier growing seasons. One of the Risky Business Study members is the executive chairman of the global agricultural giant Cargill, Greg Page. I spoke with Page and asked him about the study.
It is a business-oriented study that was sponsored and paid for by Hank Paulson, the former Secretary of the Treasury, and Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York, and Tom Steyer, who is a retired investor from California. And they had seen a lot of studies around this issue of what kind of weather and what kind of climate are we going to face as we go forward. And most of them had written more from a scientific and meteorological standpoint, and they wanted to take the same tools that they'd all used in their business lives, and Hank had been CEO of Goldman Sachs in the past, and use the principles of risk measurement and assessment that are used in looking at financial and investing risks and apply it to this issue. And so they had agreed from the very beginning, and this would predate Cargill's being asked to be involved, that they would not have a prescription, that they would put the data together, they would share the data, so it's open information, in hopes that people would use these tools in making real-time and real-world business decisions, including the potential for a variety of climate scenarios to impact those risks. And so I think one of the real wise things they did, use business principles, use the risk tools that are used in a host of other kinds of risk assessment exercises, and to have their work not start with a prescription of telling the world what to do about it or how to act, but rather how to think about it and how to put it into common business terms for use in making real-life decisions.
Well, I have a question about this that I have written down that's related to the data. I took the last hour and read through the reports and then went back through the website, but I didn't find the data anywhere. Although it talks a great deal about having actionable data in a geographically granular level for decision makers, is the data available?
But the data set is 20 terabytes, so before you ask to go to the next level, but they are going to make the information available, but I think the data set, I know from meeting yesterday in D.C., it's about 20 terabytes. So,
I had some interesting things. Define tail risk for me.
So in a normal distribution, which a lot of life takes place under normal distribution, the height of kids at 5 years old or whatever, and so in a normal distribution, you will see a range of possible outcomes, and books have been written using catchier names like black swan events. And so what tail risks are those 4 and 5 standard deviation events that could have really major implications. And so Secretary Paulson refers to them as the small but really, really deep holes. And so the probability of that event may be small, but the consequences are enormous. And in financial risk, you have to think about those as September 2008 and events like that. And so tail risk is at the end of the tails in a normal distribution curve. Either you can have positive tail risk, which isn't what, in other words, some very small possibility of a really wonderful thing happening to you, and most people don't spend a lot of time focusing on that. And then you have, of course, the negative tail or a black swan event, which is that small possibility of a very significant negative event. For agriculture, we would think of that as an inflection point where we've seen our weather more or less evolving over the last 40 or 45 years here in the Midwest. And so that would be within the normal distribution. But what if we got into an inflection point where there were a significant disruption, for instance, in the jet stream, and we got locked into a given weather pattern, whether it was no moisture or a lot of moisture or whatever, for a really extended period of time. And so the probabilities of that, and certainly Cargill does its own work with a variety of scientists, are extremely low of those kinds of things happening. But that would be a tail risk, a very low probability of a very serious event.
Tell the guys along the Iowa-Minnesota border that are looking at rainfall for the second year again.
13 inches, in June.
Yeah, they might not believe that.
But if it happened 2 months in a row, then there'd be a whole other conversation. And so that's what a tail risk is. And so in risk communication theory, that if you were doing a bond arbitrage or some type of trade, that you would, in explaining your trade to your supervisor, you would describe what your tail risks were.
Right. Okay. So when we take a look at this report as a whole, it suggests that climate change indeed is happening and that, in fact, it will have a large impact across the nation. But let's focus on your area of expertise in the Midwest, and that the agricultural areas will change, less so where you are potentially than where I happen to sit here in Champaign-Urbana. And we will go from 2.5 days over 95 degrees to something between 26 and 50 by the end of the century. And that would certainly be devastating to a corn crop.
What they tried to do, and we encourage this a great deal, since in this range of things that they talked about, one of them was coastal real estate, of course, is there's an enormous difference between having some water in the basement of your condo and having scenarios that start to really interfere with the ability to provide adequate nutrition for the population that the world may be called upon to feed it at that moment later in the century. And so what we have tried to make sure that the report, and you'll see a number of references to the unadapted yields. And so the yield projections that you see are, one, that's a range of climatic outcomes that you could have. And so there are different probabilities for each of them. There's a median probability, and there's a 1 in 20 case, which most journalists immediately went to the 1 in 20 probability case, based on the Rhodium Group's analysis of the weather data or the climatic data that they had. And so it's unadapted. And so what we are really asking for and why we participated was to make sure that agriculture, without being certain, if we knew what was certainly going to happen, then we wouldn't be taking risk decisions. We'd simply be preparing ourselves for something that we knew to be the case. But so there's a range of scenarios and there are a range of outcomes unadapted. What we think is important in agriculture is to have those conversations. If the number of 95 plus degree days went up, what are all the things that can be done in genetics? What's going to change in our springtime? Are we going to be planting on the 1st of February and having pollination take place the end of April versus doing things just the way we're doing them today? Are we going to be in a situation, and certainly we as Cargill are involved with farmers that are raising corn on the equator, and are they sowing the same seeds that we do in Blue Earth, Minnesota? No, they're not. And are they following agronomic practices that are identical? What's the relative humidity going to be? And so, yes, what you have read and what you've quoted to me is a scenario that can be contemplated by the data that was analyzed. What are the things that we collectively, all up and down the supply chain in agriculture, would have to do to adapt to that environment and preserve the yields on farms that may be dealing with weather challenges that are far outside of current experience? And if we're going to do that, don't we need to be talking about it now and getting started on the research and on all the other things that can be done to prepare for a what if?
Is there a concerted effort to look at research in these areas?
Yeah, I think you're at a university where that, I presume, is the case. And so I think that certainly there is skepticism around climate change amongst your listeners, and we fully understand that. And I would consider myself in the group of people that are inquirers and seekers, that we are all, I think, happy to know that Monsanto and other organizations are working every day to come up with genetics that will be more resilient to the potential range of weather that we could confront, not only in any given decade, but even in any given year. And certainly, I think you and your listeners would well know that people in the Red River Valley that had their planting delayed by more than 30 days made genetic change decisions that reflected the environment they were confronting at that moment. And so we need to use that same kind of resilience and project it over a longer period of time and potentially over a harsher evolution of the weather that we face.
Is there a point in history where you can look back and say these kinds of things, whether they were driven by climate or not, have happened in the past? For instance, the Corn Belt moved from Tennessee northward into Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and then again a little bit further north into Minnesota and the Dakotas, or North Dakota at least. Are there lessons that we can learn from those historical moves that happened the first time around in the late 1800s, for instance?
I think there may be. I don't know what they are specifically, but I would also say that we have to be careful not to learn too much from the past, because they didn't have the tools that we have available to us. I mean, the kinds of famines, or a lot of which were caused by exceedingly cold weather over short periods of time, some of the worst loss of life around food production has occurred as a result of significant drops in temperatures over short periods of time. So there are things that can be learned. Many of them took place at a time when there was not world trade in food, where we adjusted for a volatility in the weather by trading with each other. And I would point to this year, where a modest amount of soybeans are going to come north from Brazil to fill a little hole in our supply on the East Coast. And I think that livestock producers in Georgia and North Carolina are appreciative of the resilience that's in our system, because we have the ability to interact between nations as weather volatility moves around. So, and then clearly in farming practices and in genetic science, we're far down the road. So my guess is there are lessons that we can learn, but I think at the same time we need to take heed of the fact that we have a lot more levers to pull and a lot more tools in our toolkit to deal with these going forward.
I really want to ask you if 90 million bushels of soybeans will make it into the United States, but I'm not going to do that.
and I can honestly answer that I don't know.
Outside of the U.S., I'm thinking about the production areas across the planet. So you have Ukraine, northern China, which would be areas which much more like Minnesota, parts of Canada. They're much further north. Do they represent for you potential places across the planet that might become even more important than they are today?
Yes, I think that you can see a little bit of it already. I was in the last week in November, I was in the Ukraine and on a number of our customers' farms, and they refer to it as global climate improvement. And so they are clearly able to raise crops, and we were actually out in cornfields that were being harvested at that moment. And these were things that, talking with those farmers, they felt they just couldn't have been able to do 20 years ago. And so if you go from raising a ton an acre of wheat to raising 4 tons an acre of corn, what that means for the kind of elevators that we have and the amount of rolling stock that we need to have on the rail lines and things, there's a lot of implications for everybody all up and down the supply chain. Clearly, to get those kinds of yields, they need to use more inputs, particularly in the case of fertilizer, et cetera. And so there's an implication for every link in the agricultural supply chain as those things happen. One of the biggest capital investments that Cargill's making worldwide this year is in Camrose, Alberta. It's almost the 54th parallel north latitude, and it's an oil seed plant. And the thought that we'd be raising huge quantities of oil seeds at 54 degrees north at the time I got out of college was probably a pretty far-fetched expectation. And today it's something that we've had to do to serve our customers by putting facilities up in their marketplace to process their crops.
Will that be canola or will that be...
Canola.
Canola, right. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I spent some time in Ukraine several years ago, in 06, and at the time I knew. I walked on the properties and I knew. As soon as you hit it, you knew that that was going to be a place where corn was going to be grown and it would be moved efficiently and quickly if you could manage to build out the infrastructure.
The whole supply chain, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe we're getting a little off things, but places that I'm interested in. The problem I see in other parts of the world is, for instance, in Ukraine, they can't sell property, and trying to put together large enough tracks, and I know it's done, has mm-hmm. to be a very difficult process because they can't sell their property, and it's all in... if I remember right, up between 2 and 10 acre tracks. And so trying to put 20,000 acres together or 2,000 acres together is really difficult to do. And mm-hmm. so even in India, that would be the same problem, but that's an ownership problem there.
Different rules.
Different rules. So,
I think that all you have to think is, how would you like to have thousands, or in some cases, we have customers that have tens of thousands of landlords.
Yes, yeah.
That's the system.
That's a unique system. Is there anything, one item that you think is most important out of this risky business report that farmers across the Midwest need to take to heart and try to understand as they plan for their and their farms' futures?
Yeah, I think the big takeaway for all of us should be that, irregardless of our beliefs about the degree that things may be changing and what caused it, I think we're all experiencing, through observation, changes in the environment in which agriculture has to succeed. And so in that uncertainty, we need to have good conversations. And in a lot of cases, I think the conversations haven't taken place because there's been this fear or concern that to acknowledge that something's changing is going to lead to a government involvement or a government outcome that we don't want to see happen. And so I think we have to get past that in our conversations up and down the supply chain to make sure that as we make decisions about where to put a facility, or as the Burlington Northern decides at what elevation to put in a new set of double tracks that are going to be important to us, that they take into account. What if the 100-year flood rainfall 10 years or 20 years forward from now, when those assets will still be important to agriculture, what small cost might we invest today to make sure we have a more resilient system later if, as risk works, we end up with a harsher environment than we would have expected, either rainfall-wise or temperature-wise? Are we doing the things in terms of research investment, in terms of infrastructure? I think you know that many of us that use the river as an important part of American agricultural success have tried to get the government to enact a modest increase in the fuel tax on the river so we can put more money into the infrastructure and make it more resilient. It's all those hundreds of kinds of decisions that we're all going to be compelled to make in the decades ahead, that shouldn't we at least have a conversation about how, using good business risk management principles, we could make a more resilient agriculture to everybody's benefit. Since none of us knows for sure how it's going to turn out, what are ways that we can do to be thoughtful in our investments to minimize risks if we get an outcome that we may not have wished for or may not have predicted?
Thank you so much for taking the time with me.
Very welcome, Todd.
Greg Page is the chairman of the board for Cargill. You may learn more about the Risky Business Study on the web. The address is riskybusiness.org. The report was made possible with the financial support of Bloomberg Philanthropies, the Office of Hank Paulson, the Rockefeller Family Fund, the Skoll Global Threats Fund, and the Tomcat Charitable Trust. I conducted that interview with Greg Page, who at the time was the CEO of Cargill, in about 2013, as it was related to riskybusiness.org, a website that was launched along with all of the data as it relates to mitigating climate change. On that note, this evening you can join us here on campus. PBS NewsHour is hosting an hour and a half long live streamed event. You can see that online at willag.org and just hit the YouTube link or search it out in YouTube. And you can ask questions as well, or you can come to the Quad at the University of Illinois campus. The address will be the Illini Union on Green Street, and then you'll have to go to the backside of the Illini Union into the Quad and you'll find us there. You can join us at that point for a discussion that will include Andrew Margonaut, who we heard earlier in this hour, and many, many others. I hope to see you tonight on the Quad for the PBS NewsHour Agriculture and Climate event. Again, that starts at 6 o'clock Central Time. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online at willag.org. You can find the YouTube link there as well. Our theme music for the day was written, produced, performed by Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. I'm Todd Gleason.